From the Sky News Centre at 5, at least three cargo planes are being investigated either side of the Atlantic after reports of a suspect bomb. One of them has reportedly been stopped in the UK. Kat Wright has more.
The details are very confused at this stage, but it's understood a UPS cargo plane from Yemen to Chicago has been stopped in either London or Birmingham. FBI sources say they found no explosives. A suspicious package was found in a cargo distribution center at East Midlands Airport. Two other UPS planes are being searched at Philadelphia Airport, an earlier one in Newark.
In other news, the parent of kidnapped aid worker Linda Norgrove had told her it was the worst nightmare she might be taken hostage. She was killed during a failed rescue attempt led by US forces in Afghanistan earlier this month. Linda's mother, Lorna, says they've set up a foundation in her name to promote the causes she supported.
There's nothing going to bring her back to us. It's changed our lives completely. We feel we need to move forward and do something to help continue our work, our humanitarian work.
Millions of households are being warned to expect their energy bills to shoot up this winter. Scottish and Southern Energies announced it's raising its gas prices by 9.4% on December the 1st. Paramedics who treated survivors of the 7/7 inquest, some of the 52 victims died. Emergency medics also say they were hampered by problems with a shortage of pain relief and confusion about their roles. Cameron sees a real difference in EU budget negotiations. That's despite facing criticism he failed to prevent next year's budget being frozen or cut. And it's been a frustrating day for Take That fans trying to get tour tickets. Thousands have had to contend with websites crashing and phone lines. 9 extra dates have now been added to try and meet the demand. Tour since Robbie rejoined. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. Apologies for the digital audio madness during the Sky News there at 5 o'clock. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we start with musicians on the music industry. Can you make music to a formula in a factory like you make sausages? Bristol and Britain are both known for our musicians, but does the industry give them a break, or have the forces of darkness got their fangs into the business? And it's Halloween on Sunday evening, talking of fangs, but just how deep down Alice's rabbit hole are you prepared to go? We dig out a couple of the most disturbing stories in the world that you won't see in the Evening Post or hear on the BBC. Why are so many people are saying that the 7/7 inquest going on in London is a sick travesty of justice? And what about the well-known company built on Nazi money, which is thriving in Britain today? And if you can get through that lot, we lighten up for a close look at hidden advice about how to deal with the banksters, subtly codified into that old MGM favourite, The Wizard of Oz. That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, drizzle will be dying out this weekend, temperatures around 10 or 11 degrees Celsius. Cloudy, but more so on Sunday. Drizzle also more on Sunday. Next week, gradually getting cooler through the week, drizzly and getting wetter also throughout the week with Thursday and Friday wet. Friday the 5th of November, bonfire night then, rain is forecast. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of November, temperatures staying around about 10 degrees Celsius, clearer but rain on Sunday. The week after next, even cooler, 9 or 8 degrees Celsius, drizzle on and off throughout the week after next and getting windy too. So that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce our this week's guests now, and with me, as always, is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, economic growth, we're told this week, at the beginning of the week, is slowing down, but not as fast as was predicted. So is that good news or bad news, or is it just designed to confuse us all?
Well, I think the signposts are pointing in various directions at the moment. I personally think...
You sound confused.
Well, I think the fact is that figures for a month... or for a year are often not very enlightening, because you know it could point to a general trend, or it could just be a straw in the wind which will be countermanded by something else. I mean, my own analysis is that we are staring a very serious depression in the face, and we'll be very, very lucky to avoid it.
But these are
these things don't do anything to change the underlying prognosis, basically.
These are general figures of economic growth, and economic growth was, we were told, was going to be going down, but it's this week we've been told it's not going down quite as quickly as we thought.
Yeah, there was quite a surge in construction, but that construction is public sector construction. So what's actually happened is a lot, because there's going to be lots of cuts in public sector construction, various contracts have been signed off before before the cuts were announced, and we've had a quick surge in public sector construction as the last gasp of Labour's spending policy disappears down the plug hole.
Now, also, we hear today that from the Press Association that mortgage lending has slumped to only £112 million. Mortgage lending has dived to less than a tenth of the level seen during the previous month in September. So, actually, this is, even though we're at the end of October now, these are figures for September, and the previous month, I imagine, would be August. In September, only a tenth of the amount of money was lent out for people to buy houses than in August. I mean, this is incredible.
And net mortgage lending, as it says in the article here, by the major banks has fallen to its lowest level for a decade. So the housing market clearly is on the verge of another slump, predictably enough, because of the policies being pursued by central government.
So, I mean, how can it be that $1.62 billion was lent out in August altogether and only $112 million during September? I mean, is this because everyone's on holiday or something?
No, it's because everybody is now factoring in the impact of the cuts that the government has announced. And when they factor that in, they decide that they're not going to hire, they're not going to invest, and the property prices reflect that. I mean, city analysts said that if the Condems won the election, there would be a property collapse. Now it's happening. It's not. It's absolutely predictable. It was always said. This is one of the problems with cutting public expenditure. Middle class people who think that's a jolly good idea should just watch their house price go down the drain. That's what cutting public expenditure means. And let's see how keen they are to carry on down that road as their houses lose value year on year, decade on decade, possibly.
Well, the figures come the day after both Nationwide and the Land Registry, that was on Thursday, reported house price falls, with Nationwide saying values dropped by 0.7% during October, while the Land Registry is reporting a 0.2% slide for England and Wales in September.
Well, it's what's going to happen, isn't it? I mean, this is what a slump's all about. Britain is very dependent on the property market. That's the main way in which Britain is vulnerable in many respects as a result of our overemphasis upon private ownership of houses. And, slumps in the property market are the way in which Britain goes down the drain.
So
the US is in a very similar state. I mean, they've got similar problems there.
So what's the relationship between the property market and the rest of the economy then? Why is it so important?
Well, it's important for Britain and America because we underpin our economies by property price rises. You'll find that property prices in countries like Germany are much less volatile than they are in Britain because, basically, a lot of people rent and there's a huge rented sector in which quite wealthy people are quite happy to rent. They don't buy their own houses. In Britain, because of the history, we've encouraged private ownership of houses, which basically means people taking out loans to buy their own houses. But that then creates enormous vulnerabilities for the economy. So, for example, we have to have higher interest rates in general to keep property prices under control, which then clobbers industry. Classically, of course, you get higher property prices in the southeast, you raise interest rates, and that clobbers industry in the north. And that's always been the problem with the way the British economy functions. And this is just another version of the same old stuff. As the property price goes down, it'll pull down the economy. The deficit will increase. This is the really thing that people really got to understand, is that all of this deficit reduction machismo is going to be shown for what it is. The deficit is going to increase. And at that point, people will realise, actually, we've lost, the economy's gone down the drain and the deficit's increasing. Do these people know what they're doing? And the answer to that, I'm afraid, is no.
Well, they, of course, would say you are just simply a deficit denier, Martin. And you don't even think the deficit exists.
When the deficit goes up as a result of their policies, it's them that will be accused of deficit denial. Because their method of trying to reduce the deficit is actually going to make it worse. That would be my prediction and the prediction of many senior economists, not just me. I'm not a senior economist, I'm just a lowly level pundit. But, I mean, frankly, you can't cut your way out of a recession, as they're about to find out. No Conservative government in the 1950s would have imagined otherwise. But these youngsters have been raised on the milk of Margaret Thatcher, and they really believe their own propaganda, which is that somehow the tooth fairy is going to descend from the heavens and solve the problem, even though what they're doing is flying in the face of common sense. It won't work, and we will see very soon that it doesn't work. But this whole generation of politicians have bought into the free market ideology, and they just don't realise that that's over. The last 2 years has basically finished that whole era, but they're still living in the past.
And isn't it simply, though, that the city and the bankers, particularly the big investment banks, have been watching Cameron and Osborne, the new Conservative leaders, who are, and they're making sure that they're going to actually do these cuts that they've promised the city. And now we've seen the comprehensive spending review, the banks are then going to have more confidence in the economy and start lending again. We're going to start seeing this pick up.
Well, I understand that's the argument, Tony, but it doesn't follow, does it? I mean, what actually happens? People aren't borrowing money now. The banks are awash with cash, even though we bailed them out, and they're not lending it because nobody but a fool would lend money to somebody as you're going into a recession stroke depression, and nobody wants to borrow money either. Nobody's trying to set up a business in the face of what's going on now, or very few people, and we're in what's called technically a liquidity trap. So it doesn't matter how cheap money is, it doesn't make any difference because there's no demand in the economy, and they've not got any policy for putting demand back into the economy. In fact, they're taking demand out of the economy. The only result of that will be to crash the car. People have been telling them this ever since they got elected, and they've been very, very kind of blasé about it. But come the new year, as their head goes through the windscreen, they'll realise that they crashed the car, and so will the British people.
And what about regulation of the financial industries? You know, that used to be done by the Financial Services Authority, which was funded actually by the banks. Now, what's George Osborne and David Cameron have done is they've put the regulation into the hands of the Bank of England. Do you think that's going to improve matters?
I think the problem is, however you cut it, you've got to be prepared to actually break some legs in the city. And none of our major political parties are prepared to do that. And there's even less will to do that in the United States.
Well, I'm not talking about political parties
Wall Street
at this point.
Funds the political process.
I'm not talking about political parties at this point, Marty. I'm talking about Mervyn King and the Bank of England. Are they prepared, do you think, to be tough regulators?
No, because they were large. I mean, there was a problem of regulation being not clear who was supposed to be in charge of what. But the Bank of England, don't forget, was only given independence by Gordon Brown a decade ago. Previously, the Bank of England used to have to take its orders from the Chancellor, and there was one line of command: Prime Minister, Chancellor, Bank of England, regulation. And of course, this whole idea of separating all these things out so that there's no political interference with decisions on interest rates basically means that you are in the hands of an unelected quango called the Bank of England, which doesn't actually have to answer to the government of the day directly. Now, basically, all of these people are still living in the past. They've all been trained in the last generation on an economics which is just simply wrong. And they all believe in it because they've all been trained in it and they've all got PhDs in it. The problem is it's just wrong, and the Bank of England is simply behind the curve usually. They haven't recognised that they tend to be part of the city. They see the things the way the city sees them. And we've got a failure of imagination here by the people in charge of running the financial regulation of the country. And it's been going on for a generation.
Now, we're also supposed to be being joined this evening, live here from Barton Hill, by Councillor Helen Holland, who's the leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council. And we really want her to talk about how the comprehensive spending review and the cuts are going to affect Bristol. But apparently she's been delayed. I imagine because of the high economic activity in Bristol, we've got lots of traffic jams and lots of people going backwards and forwards to work that are stopping her. But hopefully she'll be here soon. In the meantime, this Tuesday, Robert Peston for the BBC, a remarkable post, because he's given pretty much exclusive access to a lot of stuff from the city. And he's been following around Mervyn King, who's the governor of the Bank of England. And I think it may be, Martin, that there's a bit of a change of heart going on at the bank. He says, the governor of the Bank of England, which, let us not forget, being endowed by the coalition government with direct formal responsibility for making sure banks don't go bust, said, of all the many ways of organising banking, the worst is the one we have today. It was on Tuesday. What we cannot countenance is a continuation of the system in which bank executives trade and take risks on their own account, and yet those who finance them are protected from loss by the implicit taxpayer guarantees. Now, can you put that into English, please, for me?
Well, basically, Mervyn King is like one of those headmasters who's not angry, he's just sad about what's happened. In what he's basically pointing out there is that private banks gamble and take more and more risks, but it's the taxpayer that ultimately pays off the tab if they get it wrong. That actually encourages more risky behaviour. Technically, that's called moral hazard. And he's quite right, there is moral hazard. I mean, Mervyn King was not that keen to rescue Northern Rock for that reason. But I think the problem with that is that if you allow the banking system to collapse, you then have a chaotic denouement. And I think that, as the old joke says, if I was you, I wouldn't start from here. And I saw Mervyn King testifying in front of a parliamentary committee, and he was saying, if I'd warned you about what was going to happen 2 or 3 years ago, you'd all just poo-pooed me. We're all so mad keen on deregulation and all the rest of it that even if I had my doubts and came and said we should change it, nobody would have listened to me. And I'm afraid, Tony, that the way the world works is people actually have to put their hand in the fire to realise that it burns, and that in actual fact this deregulated financial system, which began under the Tories, was allowed to flourish under New Labour, is in fact a great big bonfire, and we're all on it.
Of all the many ways of organising banking, the worst is the one we have today. Now, that's pretty a pretty powerful statement from the Governor of the Bank of England, but it's your party, the Labour Party, that's left us in this situation.
Well, the Labour Party, as all the major parties, bought into this idea that the City of London was so stacked with geniuses that they should be left to do whatever they wanted to do, and given every possible encouragement to innovate and to basically experiment with the way they operated. And everybody bought into it. I didn't buy into it, but then I'm not a leader of the Labour Party. I'm just a lowly foot soldier. Lots of people were very critical of it at the time. But, by and large, as long as it seems to be working, most people go along with it. That includes the elite and it includes the ordinary folks. And so it goes wrong, everybody thinks it's fine.
So, I mean, other parts of the world, particularly places like South America, have seen many of these things which are called IMF riots. And that is due to things like structural adjustment programmes which governments put in place on the advice of the IMF. And, of course, the International Monetary Fund has also been telling Britain what to do and eventually put together a lot of the formulas which George Osborne has been implementing as part of this comprehensive spending review. So are we going to be seeing these IMF riots on the horizon here in Britain?
Just let me correct you there. I mean, the IMF, in fact, has been actually questioning whether George Osborne is being a bit too dramatic, because don't forget the IMF basically is controlled by the US, and the US is not, in fact, cutting expenditure in the same way as Britain is cutting public expenditure. So, that's not quite true. We're having IMF riots, if you like, in France at the moment. Whether British people are going to respond in the same kind of way as French people is a moot point. It's a very different culture with a very different set of attitudes. Nonetheless, I think that social unrest and discontent is likely to mount in this country as in other countries around the world. Obviously, in France, there's a very important conflict going on there. If the protesters are able to change the government's policy, then that will give heart to protesters elsewhere. And if they're not able to change the government policy and the government forces it through, that will give heart to the deficit cutters and IMF hawks elsewhere. So it's still very interesting what's going on in France, but France isn't Britain.
Also, this is a little snippet from the Mail's diary column. Chancellor George Osborne's deficit reduction programme is supported by a group of businessmen writing to the Daily Telegraph, who include Chris Gent, chairman of the pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline. From 2003 until its collapse, Gent was also a director of Lehman Brothers. He served on the compensation committee that agreed the massive bonuses which powered the out-of-control bank. He was also on the audit committee monitoring the organisation's finances, which failed to spot the financial black hole that not only swallowed the bank, but also sent the world's economy into crisis. Chancellor Osborne must be glad to have his support. Now, what about this letter, and what about the kinds of people that have been writing it?
Well, I think it's quite interesting because some of the industries represented are industries that do well in recessions anyway. I mean, supermarkets, especially low-cost supermarkets, tend to do well in recessions. So, you know, they're not that bothered about a recession. I think there are lots of other business people who are extremely dubious about whether this will work. But their visceral loyalty to the Conservative Party and what it represents means that they're not coming out publicly and saying what they think. So these people are prepared to put their heads above the parapet. I tell you what, if there is a double-dip recession in the new year, we can all ask ourselves a question. Why is it that these top executives are all so well paid? I've just saw today that there's been a 55% increase in executive pay of those involved in the FTSE 100. This is at the same time as everybody else is tightening the belt, facing a bleak winter, 55% increase in top people's pay. I think come the new year, if there's a double-dip recession, these people are going to be A, stupid, and B, very vulnerable.
Now, I've just been told that Councillor Holland's car's broken down on the way here, so she's not going to be able to make it, but we're just going to try and get her on the telephone. The other thing about GlaxoSmithKline, Martin, is that we've also heard this week a former quality control manager at GlaxoSmithKline has received £61 million, believed to be the largest ever reward for a whistleblower, after exposing a series of contamination problems at a drugs factory in Puerto Rico and a subsequent cover-up by company bosses. Cheryl Eckard, 51, will pocket the $96 million share of a $750 million criminal and civil settlement between US regulators and the British pharmaceutical group. The case showed that the company repeatedly ignored serious failings, including allegations that staff were skimming drugs to sell them on the Latin American black market, and that its factory had mixed up different drug types and different doses in the same bottles. Now, I mean, this sounds absolutely appalling, and also the fact that this whistleblower was not listened to by her company and has had to fight all the way in order to get the truth out about the fact that the company is completely ignoring regulations. So why is George Osborne taking advice from people like Mr. Gent?
Well, he's not necessarily taking advice from them. They're cheering.
Well, they've
from
come
the
along
stands,
and to, yeah.
They're cheering from the stands.
Pat him on the back.
What I find really strange about this is that Cheryl, who's obviously done a good job here, is going to get £96 million of this criminal and civil settlement. And this just shows you the way the US works, that it's all done in courts of law, isn't it? I mean, frankly, it shouldn't take a kind of civil suit like this for this to come out. Why aren't the US regulators right down on top of this as soon as it happened? It has to. Why is it coming out through somebody, you know, basically defending an unfair dismissal case? That seems a very bizarre way for this to come out.
And it's also a little bit embarrassing, isn't it, for as a British company, you know, over there, that's
well,
getting
like
this massive.
A bit like BP. You know, it's another company not terribly popular.
So do you think this is storing up resentment by the US government and the US people against the British?
To be honest with you, how much do GlaxoSmithKline or BP represent ordinary people in Britain? And the answer is not a lot. I mean, they've got some historical ties to our country, but they are basically multinational companies. They're loyal only to themselves.
Okay, and we've just heard that Councillor Helen Holden can't phone in for some reason, no explanation, but anyway, we will press on regardless. And one of the exciting stories of the week has been the rise of housing benefit, which is incredible because housing benefit is something that hardly ever hits the news.
The rise or the cutting of it?
Well, okay, the cutting of or the capping of housing benefit. It was a House of Commons exchange on Tuesday this week that catapulted housing benefit into the spotlight. Labour's Chris Bryant tackled Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg on the Coalition's proposed cap on the amount of housing benefit, which could mean that hundreds of thousands of people on Social Security could be forced out of their homes. Let's hear from Chris Bryant in the House of Commons on Tuesday.
It is estimated that 200,000 people will be forced out of major metropolitan areas as a result of the government's niggardly proposals on welfare reform, which will turn London into Paris, with the poor consigned to the outer ring. Would it not be iniquitous if, on top of being socially engineered and sociologically cleansed out of London, the poor were also disenfranchised by his bill? How does he propose to make electoral provision for these displaced people?
To refer to cleansing will be deeply offensive to people who have witnessed ethnic cleansing in other parts of the world. It is an outrageous way of describing... No, I'll tell you exactly. I'll tell him exactly what we are doing. No. It is perfectly reasonable for the government to say that it won't hand out more in housing benefit than people who go out to work, pay their taxes, play by the rules, will do when they look for housing themselves. We are simply suggesting there should be a cap for family homes of four bedrooms of £400 a week. That is £21,000 a year. Does he really think it's wrong? Does he really think it's wrong for people who can't afford to live privately in those areas, that the state should subsidise people to the tune of more than £21,000? I don't think so.
£21,000, Martin, that seems to be a lot of money to be paying to a family in housing benefits. It's a fantastic amount of money, isn't it, coming out of the public purse?
Yes, but that's because of the property bubble we were discussing earlier. Why do you think rents are so high in London? It's because we've got this completely skewed housing market, which is geared to basically give free money to those who get on the housing ladder as part of buying their political support for the status quo. And in actual fact, of course, what we really need to do is create low-cost social housing, which will actually be much cheaper for the government. They wouldn't have to pay £21,000. £21,000 is going into the pockets of a private landlord. Now, if they're actually living in a council house, better than a social housing house, and their rents were controlled, then you wouldn't have to pay £21,000, would you?
Well, it's all very well saying that this money is going into private landlords' pockets,
indeed,
but actually what's happening is surely people are living lives of luxury in massive houses as a result.
What you're talking about is people with large families, and don't forget, somebody needs to clean inside those big offices in the centre of London, and somebody needs to do the toilets, and somebody needs to flip the burgers, and they can't commute in from Hastings every day. Now, in actual fact, the cost of housing benefit is another one of the costs of running our property market bubble-style economy. What we should have been doing over the last generation is building low-cost social housing, creating mixed social areas with some wealthy people, some middle people, some poor people, all living cheek by jowl, and you plan for that. And that's what we should have been doing. But we haven't been doing that at all. What we've been doing is squeezing the property bubble up, because that makes the people who have property wealthy. And that, if you think about who gets really wealthy from this, think about the Duke of Westminster, who's the biggest landowner in Britain. And when property prices rise by 30% in a year, as they did during the bubble, he doesn't make an extra 100,000. He makes an extra 100 million or billion. And that is the reason why we run it like that, apart from the fact, of course, that we're buying political support by giving people their own stuff back and saying, hey, oh, there you are, you've got your own council house now, you've got to support us. This is all the fault of this property-owning democracy fallacy. And that's why we're spending 21 grand. The family don't get that 21 grand. That probably goes to the Duke of Westminster.
No, but they get a nice place as a result of it, don't they?
Well, what they get is a minimal place. Yeah? That's what it costs.
£21,000 a year is not a minimal place.
Well, exactly, but that's the people who are buying their properties in central London will actually get a gift of £21,000 as the property rises in value. Now, there's no real understanding of what's underlying it. One of the things we need to do to get out of the slump is to build social housing, especially in the inner cities, where the homelessness problem is concentrated. And we could put people to work doing that, but that's not cuts, is it? That's building council housing. And Conservative governments used to know how to do this. The government in Britain which built the most council housing of all was the Conservative government of Harold Macmillan in the 1950s. And Conservatives used to understand very well why we had to do that. It's because it makes the economy more efficient, it provides roofs over people's heads, and it prevents excess housing benefit bills.
But at least this cap is going to force those who are getting most housing benefit to just simply go out and get a job.
No, they may already have a job. Don't forget that many people, again, get housing benefit who are working full-time because their wages are so low. What will happen, of course, is that the children, because that's what we're talking about here, families with large numbers of children, so all these children are going to be whipped out of school, whether they're doing their GCSEs or whatever they're doing, and they're going to be moved to bed and breakfast accommodation out in Barking. And that will cost quite a lot of money as well, except that they won't be able to commute back in to do the jobs that might be on offer. It's social engineering on a massive scale. And as in your clip pointed out, the opposition person who was speaking saying, how are you going to ensure that these people will retain their rights to vote? Because this has got smells very similar to the gerrymandering scandal in Westminster Council in the 1980s, if you remember that, Tony, when Shirley Porter, who was the Conservative leader of the council, connived to get people thrown out of their houses so that they could be sold off to incoming Conservative potentially conservative voters.
But that was social housing, wasn't it? That was council houses that they were being. Most, if not all, of the people who would be affected by this will be private landlords.
Well, the answer to this is to provide social housing inside the London boroughs where these people live, and then you wouldn't have to pay £21,000 to house them, would you? And we've been paying that £21,000 for years and years and years. Why do it has to change now? Well, because we've got no money. Now, the answer, we've got lots of money. There's lots of money been made in the bubble in the city. And the 55% increase, 55% increase in top people's pay this year alone. There's a lot of money there, you know.
We've also heard that the row over the government's housing benefit cuts has escalated as Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, said he would not accept Kosovo-style social cleansing. Well, I'm not sure that's exactly what Chris Bryant was suggesting in the capital. In remarks criticised by ministers, including David Cameron, Mr Johnson insisted he would not allow thousands of poorer families to be forced out of London by benefit reforms.
Yes, but he's rowed back on that now. He's basically had his arm twisted. And
Mr Johnson,
and
very good.
Broken, and he's decided he doesn't think like
You've anticipated me, Martin, very well there. Mr Johnson later issued a statement saying he'd been quoted out of context and the reform of a housing benefit system was absolutely right. He stressed that his point was that London had specific needs and that he and ministers were continuing to negotiate a package of measures to ensure the changes were introduced in London with minimal problems, whatever that means. The planned moves include a £400 a week housing benefit cap for four-bedroomed homes and a 10% reduction for the long-term unemployed. Now, this is really just surely a way of getting people into work, as I was saying before.
10% reduction for the long-term unemployed. So you've been unemployed for over a year. And of course, everybody knows the longer you are unemployed, the more difficult it is to get employment. And then we're going to cut your benefit by 10%, which means effectively you can't pay your rent. So having been made unemployed, long-term unemployed, we're now going to make you homeless, which will really help you find a job, won't it?
This is
just silliness, frankly.
This piece is from the Press Association, but more than 750,000 claimants could be affected by changes to the way local housing allowance levels are calculated. The housing benefit cap will come into force next April, tougher limits on local housing allowance next October, and the 10% cut for the long-term unemployed in 2013. Now, do you think that they're going to be able to keep to that programme of implementing this?
They won't. I mean, there was a very interesting article in The Observer this week by a top civil servant writing anonymously. And he said, we're just having a real laugh about all these things they're talking about because we know that none of it is workable. They've basically worked all this out on the back of an envelope. And as they try and implement it, they're discovering that there are all kinds of actual problems in the real world, which you haven't thought about.
Well, it may be painful, but they are the government. They do make these decisions.
Yes, and they can also make the wrong decision. For them, from their own point of view, I mean, it's actually in actual fact, public borrowing went up since the Condems came to power, not down, up. That's the direction of the deficit. And as they go forward, cutting their way, the deficit is going to get bigger, not smaller, bigger. And so even their centrepiece, the thing they're saying, oh well, it's all pretty hard, but at least we're going to cut the deficit. When it becomes clear in the new year that the deficit is actually bigger, then they are going to look like fools.
Okay, moving on to last Saturday's Anti-Cuts Alliance demonstration in Bristol City Centre. Martin, you were there. Can you just tell us how it all went? I think it was raining, wasn't it? Absolutely.
It wasn't raining. It was spitting.
I saw some pictures of the speakers having to give their speeches whilst Nina Franklin from the National Union of Teachers was holding an umbrella over their heads. I don't think she was doing that to stop the sun.
It was raining, but not enough to deter the demonstrators, let's put it that way.
What was the thrust of the speeches that were being made?
Well, basically saying much the same sort of thing as I've been saying in the first part of this programme, that the policies being pursued are unfair and that they won't work and that something has got to give.
As usual, there's a dispute over the numbers of people that actually attended this. It was originally a rally at Castle Park and then a march through the city centre at 12 o'clock, a rally on College Green. The police said 500 people were there, a reflection on the judgments they make throughout the day, and the BBC said 1,000, but they didn't make it a count. Now, you're going to probably tell me it was 1,500, Martin, so I think we can say it was about 1,000 people.
It was enough people to show that there is some opposition to what's going on. But obviously, it's nothing like what we've seen in France, where millions of people have taken to the streets.
Anyway, we hear from Britain, Nigel Varley, who's the rally organiser for Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, that during the march, the police liaison officer came to him and asked him to do something about a group of young people on the march who were wearing hoods. Everybody was, because it was raining, he says, and carrying a banner with the slogan, which I can't say here, F your cuts on it. The banner was not on poles, and the police said did not say anyone had complained about it. They wanted the stewards to remove it, and when I refused, they demanded that the stewards line up in front of the banner so nobody could see it. The police seem to think the Alliance is a monolithic block which issues orders. Whilst personally I think swear words on a banner are inappropriate for this kind of demonstration, I'm not too keen on the face mask posturing. It's not the job of the Alliance Steering Committee to curtail anybody's freedom of expression. So can you tell us, first of all, what happened, and then Martin, maybe give us a bit of assessment of the rights and wrongs of the police wading in on this demonstration?
Well, I didn't see everything. I'm one of the people on the demonstration, but I don't see everything. It depends where you happen to be standing. I understand that a group of young people has suggested were carrying a rather provocative banner, and some of them had basically pulled their hoods up and looked a bit menacing. Frankly, I think the police overreacted here. They were not causing any real danger to anybody else. Their freedom of speech to say nasty words, I would just say ignore it, frankly. The police,
at this point, Nigel Varley says at this point, then a group of police in riot gear materialised as if from nowhere. The joint chairs of the Alliance, John McAnally, who was on this programme a few weeks ago, remonstrated with them, but they charged into the march to grab the banner, and a short, intense scuffle broke out. Do you think it's right for the police to be doing this kind of thing?
Unwise for them to do that. In actual fact, there was a bit of a scuffle, and there was a bit of ill temper because people don't like being pushed around and bullied and attacked. I think the police made a mistake. It's quite easy to just ignore small things like somebody with a slightly provocative banner. It's pouring with rain. We're on College Green. Nobody can really see the banner. Nobody really cares. And the police would have been wiser to simply turn a blind eye rather than try and enforce. They could have provoked an incident there. It's quite possible that if people had been a bit more belligerent, we could have had a full-on confrontation between the demonstrators and the police. And we don't want to see that. Nobody wants to see that. And the police would be wiser, frankly, to take a softly, softly approach.
Anyway, the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance statement winds up: the obstacles that have been put in our way and the disruption of our legitimate activity call into question our right to peaceful assembly and protest in the city of Bristol. We intend to take this up with the council, our MPs and the Independent Police Complaints Commission, and the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance calls on the trade unions and organisations that took part in the rally to lodge a complaint immediately with the Chief Constable and Avon and Somerset Police. They cannot be allowed to get away with it, he says. That's Nigel Varley, who's the organiser of last Saturday's rally. Ultimately, Martin, do you think that the police are kind of looking for trouble when they're policing these demonstrations?
I understand that when the organisers were talking to the police in advance of the rally, first of all, the police said, we're not going to send anybody to police the demonstration unless you pay for them to attend. And that was the line. And the organisers said, oh, very well, then we will organise stewards for the demonstration. That they said they couldn't afford to send anybody. Then it transpired, when we got there, I did actually speak to the police. I said, I thought you weren't going to be here and that you couldn't afford to send anybody. But they'd also been speaking to the organisers saying, oh, we've heard that the march is going to be infiltrated by anarchists. Now, this is all very, very silly. The march isn't being infiltrated by anarchists. The anarchists are part of the broad spectrum of people who are opposed to the cuts. We've had anarchists on this programme, as you know, and they're as much entitled to be there as anybody else. But the police interpreted this as threatening and dangerous, and they had a whole riot squad there ready to deal with these young people, etc., etc.
But surely the police... But
the fact was, there was no real danger of any disorder whatsoever other than that caused by the police.
But surely, if they're swearing on their banners, the police have every right to go and make sure that those offensive language is removed from the public sphere.
I think this is a very important point, isn't it? At what point are you not allowed to, what can you not write on banners? I think these young people were unwise to be provocative, But then you've got to, we talk about people getting involved in politics and so on. Now, are we saying to young people, we want you to get involved in politics, but when you turn up and you don't behave according to the rules as we lay them down, then we're going to beat you up and arrest you? I think that's not right. People have got to be allowed to express themselves. People are angry about these cuts. They are. They know very well that a lot of this is directed exactly at them. Many of these people struggle to get housing. They know exactly what the issues are. And I'm afraid if Middle England's going to get fed up by a few swear words, then they've got a very nasty shot coming. The big society is going to be on the doorsteps of the government and of the powerful. And I'm afraid it's not going to be a pretty sight.
Well, it does. Nigel Varley, who's the rally organiser, does say that he believes that the police were looking for any excuse to have a go at, in inverted commas, the anarchists. Anyway, moving on, Denmark, New Zealand and Singapore are topping the list this week of the least corrupt countries in the world. Hugo Chavez, for example, in Venezuela, his country ranked 164, very low down, below countries such as Zimbabwe, Sierra Leone and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Responding to the survey, the Venezuelan ambassador to the UK and Ireland, Dr. Samuel Moncada, called the Corruption Perception Index hot air and propaganda. Speaking on BBC's Newsnight programme, he said rich countries play an integral part in the corruption of the poor countries. When we talk about drug money, banks and the financial crisis, private banks received millions of pounds of public money and nobody in the rich countries calls that corruption. If that happened in Venezuela, we would have been called the most corrupt country in the world. So do you think this is spin, or is it actually quite a useful index of corruption, Martin?
Well, I think it's a useful index of corruption, but of course the idea that corruption in a country is specific to that country is wrong, as the ambassador has pointed out. For example, Saudi Arabia probably ranks fairly as a fairly corrupt country, but who corrupts them? Oh, it's British Aerospace based at Filton. They're the ones who corrupt them. Now, who's corrupt? Is it the Saudis for taking the money, or British Aerospace for offering the money? Does that count as Saudi corruption, or does that count as British corruption?
Well, that's an interesting point, because the newest arms deal that's been done with the Saudis, of course, is not a British arms manufacturer, it's a US.
Well, indeed, and most, as we well know, these deals are often greased. So the poor countries, I mean, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime issued a report a few months ago pointing out that the major banks laundered huge amounts of drug money during the financial crisis. Now, in other words, is that Colombian corruption, or is it City of London corruption? Because it's the Colombian money that went through the City of London. Now, is that Colombian corruption, or is that our corruption? I think it's our corruption, actually.
Next story, the West must oppose the execution of Tariq Aziz. And this is a letter in The Guardian a couple of days ago by the Right Reverend Peter B. Price, who's the Bishop of Bath and Wells, the Right Reverend Colin Bennett, who's the Bishop of Coventry, was the Bishop of Coventry, and someone called Major General Tim Cross, who's a retired Army Major General. And they're basically saying that the undersigned bishops met with Mr. Aziz during a visit to Iraq in 1999 when he was Foreign Minister in Saddam Hussein's government. During our conversation, we appealed to him for an end to the suffering which Saddam's regime brought so many people in Iraq. And particularly, we drew Mr. Aziz's attention to the suffering of children in hospitals where medical equipment and medication were being withheld. Now, we do not question the guilt of Mr. Aziz in respect of the crimes which he has been convicted of, and we hold no brief for his activities under Saddam Hussein. He's currently a very ill man and will probably die from his illness soon. Our appeal is on a humanitarian basis, they say. Nothing will be served by his execution. He's largely been forgotten during the imprisonment since giving himself up to the coalition forces back in 2003. His own view that he would die in prison would, in our view, be quite a sufficient punishment. The indiscriminate use of the death penalty during Saddam's regime was widely condemned in the West. To support such action now would be a failure of moral courage. If Iraq is to rebuild itself and find its proper place in the community of nations, it needs to commit itself to the principles of the UN Declaration on Human Rights.
Well, the Pope has also called for clemency for Tariq Aziz. He was the only Christian in Saddam Hussein's leadership, so that's why the churches are taking a particular interest in this. I understand that the EU are calling for the death penalty not to be imposed, because that's EU policy to oppose the death penalty in most cases. I think it's very interesting that Tariq Aziz was not put on trial by the International Criminal Court, because, of course, if he'd been put on trial in The Hague, his first line of defence would be Yes, but I worked very closely with US and British intelligence services in the 1980s. How do you think we got hold of our chemical and biological weapons? You know very well, I've got documents here, his defence lawyers would say, you sold them to us and you actually gave them to us so that we could defeat the Iranians. And in actual fact, Tariq Aziz would say, as an international criminal court defendant would say, and I want to call witnesses, I want to call Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Margaret Thatcher, I want to call them because they were dealing with us. And of course at that point, the investigation widens. And it's not just about Tariq Aziz. That's why he's not been put on trial at the International Criminal Court, which is why he's been tried specifically for small, minor offences inside Iraq, which he's going to be executed for. Now, of course, this is why we need justice and not vengeance, because then we can find out what really happened, who really backed Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. And you know what? It was all the top people in the West. They thought Saddam Hussein was a great guy, because he was dealing with the Iranians for them. And they gave him money, they gave him arms, they gave him full support. And of course, that's what Tariq Aziz's defence would be. And then, of course, we might have to look at prosecuting some of our own people in the International Criminal Court. There's a reason why the Americans haven't signed up to it, isn't there? Because they don't want to be taking their people in the dock.
So do you think, would you go so far as to say the same may be true for Saddam Hussein himself? Do you think he may have evidence against the Western leaders?
That's why Saddam Hussein was tried in a kangaroo court in Iraq. Because if he'd been tried under international law at the International Criminal Court, that would have been his defence as well. Which is, look, you know, you and I, we were in it together, weren't we? You're having me executed, but you used to be my best mates.
So you could say that this, both the execution of Saddam Hussein and of Tariq Aziz, is a way of basically silencing witnesses who may be able to testify against war criminals.
When we do put our own war criminals on trial, which I hope we eventually will, I'm talking about the Bushes and Blairs of the world, we won't execute them. You should never execute people in those circumstances because you can always get some more information out of them. Dead men tell no tales. I want to see people like Bush and Blair in prison for the rest of their lives and, of course, being called back to court for further interrogations as we go through the whole of the Pentagon, the CIA and all these other criminals.
So where is this going then? I mean, do you think this is maybe Tariq Aziz is the last Iraqi that's going to be executed like this?
Oh, goodness knows. Unfortunately, he's not going to be the last Iraqi to die because the war drags on. People have got used to the idea that it's over, but it isn't over. It's not over by a long shot. People are dying every day. We saw these WikiLeaks revelations in the last week. People are being tortured with electric drills, electrocuted, assassinated. Pretty grim stuff.
But the media really don't have access to a lot of these war zones, do they? Maybe that's why we're not hearing about these things and there's no exposure of it. Why is it that WikiLeaks is the only people, you know, who are, and Julian Assange is the only people that are exposing this stuff?
Well, because what's happened is that the news management has become a very important part of what the military does. So they get embed reporters with their own troops, which gives a very partial view of what's going on. You get a bomb's eye view of the war as things drop from the sky, but the kind of pictures we used to see from Vietnam from independent reporters are pretty much excised from the record. And of course, the only way we can get to the truth is when leaks happen, as the ones we've seen happen. I mean, they haven't leaked all the top. It's fairly low level intelligence that's been leaked, but the picture painted of what's going on is pretty grotesque and gruesome.
Now, if you turn to the internet, there's a very hot dispute on the internet, really, about the veracity or otherwise of WikiLeaks and whether the way that the material has been being leaked in a kind of partial fashion actually serves the interests of the Pentagon rather than against it.
Well, the Iranians...
Can you just explain how that can possibly be true?
Don't forget that these people are experts in psychological warfare. Psychological warfare involves trying to condition both your enemies and your potential allies to see the world in the way you want them to see it. So we get a kind of Punch and Judy show where we've got the Pentagon saying, oh, we don't want these leaks to come out. We don't want these leaks to come out. This is terrible. And this, of course, gives WikiLeaks credibility. Yeah. So then when WikiLeaks says something, it has credibility even amongst critical people like you and me. And that can be, I'm not saying it is, but it can be a way to neutralise even more fundamental criticism.
But how can this latest WikiLeaks revelation about torture, etc. in Iraq, how could that be spun to actually be of benefit to the US?
If you notice that what's being suggested here is it's the Iraqi security forces who've been torturing people, the Americans At least we've got no direct documentation from WikiLeaks suggesting that the Americans were torturing people, and the Americans are being accused of turning a blind eye to Iraqi torture. Now, many people in Iraq believe that the death squads inside the Iraqi government are not just being turned a blind eye to by the Americans, but are being orchestrated by the Americans. And many people believe that they're also orchestrating the insurgency. Now, this sounds crazy to people who are brought up on a diet of mainstream news, but the reality is modern psychological warfare techniques are all about perception management. Ask General Petraeus. And you end up with a situation where you are running the death squads, you're running the terrorists, and you're running the perception of what's going on. Now, many people in the Middle East perceive that to be the case. In Pakistan, many senior generals have suggested, many senior generals in Pakistan are suggesting that the Americans are behind some of the terrorism inside Pakistan. Karzai is suggesting that Blackwater are behind some of the terrorism inside
Afghanistan. Well, he's not just suggesting it, he's saying they definitely are, yes. And he's ordered them out of the country.
Indeed. And of course the mainstream media here throws up its hands and says, oh, this ungrateful person, blah, blah, blah. But what people have got to understand is out there in the big wide world, in Afghanistan, in Colombia, in Pakistan, where they put up with an awful lot more terrorism than we do here in Bristol, and they know an awful lot more about it, the perception that the Western intelligence services are behind terrorist attacks is widespread. It's not a minority opinion. The Iranian government, when Ahmadinejad went to the UN and hinted that the Iranian Secret Service do not believe the American story about 9/11, and everybody went bonkers, or the Western powers stormed out in a fury, but everybody else stayed. And that includes the Chinese, the Russians, the Brazilians, the South Africans, the Indians. They all stayed because they know that the Western intelligence services are terrorists. Not always, but sometimes.
Okay, now on to a local story. The Tories in Bristol are calling for the sell-off of Bristol's green spaces to be scrapped. Conservatives have tabled a motion calling for the £87 million plan to sell off up to 62 green spaces across Bristol to be scrapped. Bristol City Council attracted a significant amount of opposition to the area green spaces plan since the consultation began in June. Residents have opposed at least one in four of the sites put forward for disposal, and many are against the general principle of sending off green space at all. Thousands of signatures have been added to a variety of petitions opposing sell-off of individual sites, including Wellington Field in Hawfield, St Anne's Park and Lodge Hill near Fish Ponds. Now, I think I'm right in saying that today is the deadline for anyone campaigning, so maybe that's why we've just seen that the politicians in the city actually saying that they don't believe that any of this should go ahead. Councillor Mark Weston for Henbury's Conservative said that public consultation has clearly shown that Bristolians simply do not want to lose any more of their recreational space. The area green space plans are fundamentally dishonest, he says, in that many potential plots of land suggested for sale are not, as previously promised, of low value or quality. Councillor Tess Green for Southfield from the Green Party said the Green Party has always opposed selling any green space which is valued by local people, although we could see the logic of selling off space that is not valued in order to improve green space more generally. The voice of local people has been very strong on this issue and it needs to be taken seriously. Executive Member for Targeted Improvements, that's Councillor Gary Hopkins from the Liberal Party, said, quite frankly, the Tories are making fools of themselves. They've lost the trust of the parks movement. This is all about improving our parks. So as the long consultation over several months into which green spaces people feel very strongly should be kept or not comes to an end, Martin, do you think we've heard the end of this now? And or do you think that there's going to be more, attempts to actually stop any of these green spaces being sold off by the opposition in the council?
Well, I think people are going to carry on protesting, obviously, because people feel very strongly about it. I think we've got a Liberal regime in Bristol now, and obviously they're committed to the parks strategy, although perhaps not as committed as Councillor Hopkins as an individual. But all the other political forces in the city, the Conservatives, the Greens, the Labour Party, they're responding to public pressure, which is basically that people don't want these green spaces sold off. And at the end of the day, you know, that what people really want is ultimately what local councils have to do.
Well, is it? Because the Liberals have a majority, don't they? They can just do this, whatever they want.
They do, and if they go ahead in the face of all of this opposition, they may find come next May that they're going to lose some votes as a result of it. I mean, if they really believe in it, then they probably will go ahead with it. But I think they'd be wise to listen to the kind of criticisms and suggestions that are being made to them. It shouldn't be a party political issue. I mean, we should be able to have a reasonable discussion about this and come to some reasonable compromise, it seems to me. And I think that, you know, it's only when you try and do something and you raise opposition that you realise that people don't particularly want to go down that road. And Councillor Hopkins was on this programme a few weeks ago, and he was saying that there was no real financial reason for approaching it in this way. It's not as if it's a money-saving thing. It's to do with a strategy. And that they've consulted on the strategy to try and improve the existing parks, but they haven't consulted with people who are going to lose their bit of green space, and they're, of course, making their voice heard. And that's the way it works, isn't it?
OK, in London, firefighters plan to strike on bonfire night. That's another story we've heard this week. Now, the London Fire Authority has appealed on Tuesday to striking firefighters to call off a planned stoppage on bonfire night, usually near their busiest night of the year. Now, now this sounds to me, Martin, rather like your leader Ed Miliband's bad idea for a strike. Now, do you think that this is a wise move for the firefighters to be calling their strike on such a dangerous night for the city?
Well, I mean, I noticed that you haven't covered in any of what you've said what they're striking about. And I think that needs, before you make any comment about a strike, you have to actually get to the bottom. Why is it that people, I mean, firefighters don't go on strike easily. In fact, they very, very rarely do so. It's a very, very blue moon when the firefighters go on strike. I know we had a big dispute a few years ago, but that was, you know, that was the first one for 10 years. And if the London Fire Brigade are fed up because they feel that safety is going to be compromised and jobs are going to be lost as a result of what's being suggested by the London Fire Authority.
Now, I know Jeremy Corbyn in the House of Commons actually did say that some firefighters in London had actually received dismissal letters, at least warning of potential dismissal letters through the post.
Well, indeed. And I think that what needs to happen here, I think John Snow was interviewing the leader of the Fire Authority on Channel 4 News the other night, and he said, well, surely you should just get together with these people and try and sort it out before bonfire night. And apparently he agreed on Channel 4 News that he would go and meet with the firefighters. A time was set, 9 o'clock the following morning, and he didn't turn up. And I think the London Fire Brigade people, the firefighters themselves, believe that there is an attempt to break the union's strength in the London region. And I'm afraid that, you know, if you're going to have a strike, you've got to make it effective. And maybe if people are worried about this and there is a strike on bonfire night, well, maybe no bonfires then, if we're going to be safe.
Well, there's a final story this week. The ministers plan a huge sell-off of Britain's forests. Ministers are planning a sell-off of the Britain's government-owned forests as they seek to save billions of pounds to help cut the deficit. The Sunday Telegraph has learned. That was obviously the Sunday Telegraph. Apparently, laws governing Britain's forests were included in the Magna Carta of 1215, and some date back even earlier. Can you just briefly comment, Martin, then, on the wisdom or otherwise of this approach to raising money?
It's the slash and burn approach that we've got in virtually every other sector, isn't it? And in we're going to sell off the forest, which to private enterprise, to be cut down and turned into chopsticks or whatever. Rather typical of everything else that's going on.
Now, Peter Hack, who's a Bristol resident, who I've met a few years ago, he wrote a letter into The Guardian, I think yesterday or the day before, saying that this actually could be a landowner benefits scam because, of course, rich people don't pay any tax on forests that they own.
Yes, that's jolly handy. The Country Landowners Association are quite keen on forests for that reason.
OK, well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Apologies for not bringing you Helen Holland. I've heard that her car broke down on the way here and she was in a rather dangerous place and had to push it off the road. So that's why she couldn't,
right.
she couldn't phone in. Anyway, thanks very much to Martin Summers, who's been with us for the last hour discussing the week's news. After the news, can you make music to a formula in a factory? like you make sausages. Bristol and Britain are both known for our musicians, but does the industry give them a break, or have the forces of darkness got their fangs into the business? Also, it's Halloween on Sunday evening, but just how deep down Alice's rabbit hole are you prepared to go? We dig out a couple of the most disturbing stories in the world that you won't see in the Evening Post or on the BBC. Why are many people saying that the 7-7 inquest going on in London is a sick travesty of justice? And what about the well-known company built on Nazi money, which is apparently unrepentant and thriving in Britain today? And if you can get through that lot, we lighten up for a close look at hidden advice about how to deal with the banksters, subtly codified into that old MGM favourite, The Wizard of Oz. Join us after the news. And remember, the clocks go back on Saturday night.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody information.